The million-dollar question, how do entrepreneurs transition from self-employed to owning a business that turns a profit? My name is Chris Waters, and this podcast has the million-dollar answer. Welcome to CEO Secrets.
Hey guys, it's your host, Chris Waters. Welcome to CEO Secrets. I've got a really special guest on today, Jeremy Brandt from FastHomeOffers.com. He actually has a network way beyond just FastHomeOffers.com. He is also in the space of providing a business in a box for people that want to start a business buying distressed homes across the United States. And he's also has a referral platform for real estate agents. Jeremy, welcome to CEO Secrets.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how long ago did you get into the distressed asset business, helping people, you know, with distressed, I assume, is primarily single family homes?
Primarily single family homes, a little bit of commercial and a little bit of multifamily, but primarily single family. I've been involved in this for almost 20 years now. I started my career in kind of the high tech space, working with dot-coms and doing a lot of technology things. And when I got into house flipping, I really just took some of that background and applied it to the house flipping world. And that evolved into the businesses that we have now that provide leads and resources to real estate investors and agents and brokers.
How's, you know, so 20 years ago, let's see, Google AdWords really just, was it, they came up with the algorithm in 03, 06, somewhere in that time frame?
So we were, Google AdWords was actually running strong. We were doing a lot of ads on the Google network, a lot of SEO, you know, SEO was really easy to do back then. And then a lot of advertising with a company called Overture, which is what became the Microsoft, Bing, and Yahoo advertising network. So pay-per-click advertising was definitely in its infancy at the time. I remember back in 2001, 2002, it was like 3 or 4 cents a click for real estate-related clicks at the time, which was
wow.
That was the heyday of advertising for us, for sure.
For people watching this, what's the general range on a cost-per-click basis for, essentially generating distressed seller leads? What kind of cost per click is it now? And then could you break that into a cost per lead? Just, I know it's wide, there's a wide range depending on where in the US you are. What's the low end and high end?
For sure. Yeah, so we advertise nationally all over the US, and the price per click, which ultimately is price per lead, varies drastically by geography, as you might imagine, right? More rural areas that have lower cost of houses and less competition are much less expensive. But I'd say on the low end, cost per clicks are $10, $12, and cost per lead might be $50, $60, $70 on the really low end rural markets. You get into some areas like Los Angeles, New York City, high-end expensive markets with a tech-savvy population and a lot of competition, you could be looking at $100 cost per click, which is amazing for a single click, which gets you to $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 cost per lead to generate leads around motivated home sellers. So it's really a massive range all across the country.
So you have a business called We Buy Houses, which is a franchise system that you kind of like We Buy Ugly Homes. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So we're not a franchise. WeBuyHouses.com. We looked at the kind of environment and looked at the ugly house guys and some other things in the market, decided we want to do things a little bit differently. So what we did is we created a brand license where people that are already really experienced, successful residential real estate investors want to scale up their business. And we license out the WeBuyHouses.com brand. We give them marketing tools, TV commercials, billboard designs. We have an in-house ad agency that runs all the online marketing. And we really put the WeBuyHouses.com brand on top of their existing business to help them scale it up faster and better. We felt like the franchising model just wasn't a good fit for the residential real estate investing community for us, because we didn't want to train people that had a McDonald's and now want to be a real estate investor on the soup to nuts how to be a real estate investor. We really wanted to take experienced people and help them level up their business, which we've been very successful in doing. We've got I think about 70 or 80 offices all over the country. We're buying 3,000-4,000 houses a year. And it's been really, really great. We started that business about 7-8 years ago now, and we've got some just incredible investors in the system now.
In terms of conversions, when you think about how many leads it takes to get a deal under contract, I'm sure that's it's obviously a function of skill for the salesperson, but any general range of how many distressed seller leads you have to generate to close a deal?
Yeah, so that's a that is a there's a lot of factors that go into that, and we talk about that all the time in our lead gen business and in our brand license business. A lot of it has to do with what tools are in your belt. So, you know, if you're just a fix and flip real estate investor and you're going to try to make offers that are 75 cents on the dollar minus repairs, you're going to get a very small percentage of home sellers that you talk to that are the right fit for that solution. So you might be looking at, you know, one in 20, one in 25, one in 30 people that you talk to that are a fit for that very specific type of situation. Now, when you kind of expand a little bit and you make offers that are more in the 80-85% range of market value, you'll end up closing a lot more deals when people start getting into some of the creative ways of real estate investing, subject tos, lease options, other ways of creatively working with home sellers to help them out of their situation, the number goes up even more. And then what a lot of our clients do is that they own real estate brokerages as well. And so once you then also have the option to list the home, you might be looking at a 1 in 5 or 1 in 7 home sellers that you work with that if you've got all the tools in your belt, you can provide a solution to them, whether it's, I'm going to buy your house for cash, I'm going to help you sell it through a listing, or I'm going to do something else kind of creative in the middle.
When you think about lead quality with all the different mediums of advertising, how would you rank them in terms of, you know, best to worst, irrespective of cost?
Yeah.
Like when you think about lead sources, what would be from top to bottom, best to worst?
Yeah. Well, I think this applies in almost all forms of marketing, you know, real estate especially, but you can think for, you know, any of your viewers that are just business owners in other industries. The highest quality lead or the highest quality prospect in your system is somebody who is looking for the solution that you provide. So they're out there searching for that solution and they find you in the process. So for us, that looks like SEO and pay-per-click are some of the highest quality. They're also the most expensive, but they're the highest quality sources of leads because all of those home sellers went out searching for a solution to their problem, found us, and now we're going to provide that solution for them. So they're very motivated and ready to take action today versus, you know, things like display advertising, Facebook advertising, Instagram advertising, all good forms of advertising, but they're interruption based where you're interrupting the consumer's kind of feed with information that might be interesting to them. So you end up getting a lot more tire kicker type of people that are just curious, what is this about? I want more information, which isn't bad, but you have to kind of run them through a longer funnel or kind of warm them up over a long period of time before they're going to turn into an actual client. And then there's, you know, the other broadcast forms of advertising, TV, radio, billboard. Again, all of those are advertising to the masses. And somebody says, well, I could maybe use that solution. Let me give them a call. It's great. But again, you're going to wade through a lot of looky-loo, tire kicker kind of people to get to the people that are really motivated and ready to take action right now.
So We Buy Ugly Homes? Anyways, their network. It seems like they're really big into doing billboards. Is that more of a branding play for them, for people to just, you know, to build a brand equity in the mind of the consumer, and then they Google the company, or is billboards an actual effective, you know, medium to get to attract distressed sellers?
I've found that billboards are a fairly low return on investment advertising method. I think they really, you know, in my opinion, they do it for the brand building to get the brand out there. And because they're a franchise and they might put 10, 20, 30 franchisees in a market, that billboard advertising brings them more franchisees, which is really their primary source of revenue. And so I think that drives that type of advertising. We've done lots of billboard advertising in the real estate space. It really makes sense on the distressed home seller side, only if you're getting remainder inventory. Rack rate for billboards is really expensive, you know, and they charge that to the movie studios and the big brands. But there's a lot of times that billboards go unsold and you can get a billboard for half, a third, a quarter of the cost of what they quote you up front if you're willing to take a billboard that's open and nobody else is on right now.
Yeah. On the marketing front, also another popular medium is direct mail. And you go through all these coaching programs and they all, you know, they talk about how the biggest buyers across the country are sending out 100,000 pieces of mail a week or something crazy. What's your take on, you know, these? I mean, I've seen them, they're like blue and yellow, first notice, second notice, third notice, final notice. What's your take on on the the direct mail strategy that a lot of these people push?
Yeah, I think direct mail is good. It's like a lot of things. TV can be good and it can be horrible. It's all about the strategy that you've implemented around TV advertising. If you advertise on one show, you might get no calls. If you advertise on another show, you might get a lot of calls. Direct mail is really the same way. If you do, mass broadcast direct mail, EDDM, they call it, every door direct mail. I've found that to be a really low return on investment because you're hitting 98% of the people with a piece of direct mail that don't care about your message. Where I think direct mail is really effective is when you tightly target it to the exact type of consumer that is most relevant to the service that you provide. So in the case of a real estate agent or real estate broker, there's a lot of demographics around, how often do people move? When are they likely to move? Expired listings, all those different types of things that have a really high indicator that somebody's ready to do something. That's a great list to direct mail to. In the real estate investing world, our demographics are more like non-owner occupied homes. So somebody's rental house or Airbnb that's turning into a headache and is a lot of work. People that have lived in their house for over a certain number of years, which likely means that it's in a state of disrepair. People that are older that lived in the houses that might be retiring soon and also haven't kept their houses up. So there's a lot of demographics that we can narrow in and only send direct mail to out of 1,000 people, the 25 or 30 people that are likely to sell their house and need to sell it using our services versus everybody in the neighborhood or everybody in the zip code.
Is there any kind of, like technology or marketing medium you're excited about in the future to help with delivering high quality leads for your clients and your the people you're licensing the branding to? Where's your head at on that? What's the future of marketing and technology look like from a lead generation perspective?
Yeah, I think everybody's always looking to reinvent the wheel and whatever the latest kind of exciting marketing platform or venue is. I really like sticking with the basics, direct mail, TV that's targeted, pay-per-click advertising, SEO. So I think all of that stuff, the foundation of marketing, especially in lead gen or, what is really the equivalent of direct response, where you are trying to not really build a brand, you're just trying to directly get somebody to respond to your offer or to the thing that you have. So I think all of those things, the basics are really, really strong. What I'm most excited about really is the kind of artificial intelligence, automated advertising platforms and technologies where you can take a lot of inputs from your CRM system or from your back office or from whatever you use to track all of your leads and track your return on investment for those leads, that then also plugs into Google AdWords or Bing Ads or all the different advertising sources and can at a very rapid rate give you automated bidding strategies to maximize your advertising dollar and then also maximize the exact type of consumer that you want to put your ad in front of without, spending hours and hours and hours trying to manage an advertising account. So I think those are getting really, really good. Google's pushing a lot of their automated bidding platform within Google Ads. And I think over the next couple of years, we'll really see that take off in a way that will provide a better return on investment for advertisers, which is ultimately what we all care about.
So on the AI side, are you referencing a third-party vendor that works with Google? Or is it, like, for example, have you heard of Albert.ai?
Mm-mm.
No? Okay. Are you referencing something that's a tool within Google?
Yeah, so Google is building a lot of internal tools that you can use to run some of these automations. And then out of that, a lot of companies, ourselves included, are building automated bidding strategies and technologies that are relatively rudimentary, but really getting in that first level of not having a human manage all of your advertising, having a long set of rules that is ultimately what artificial intelligence is when we talk about AI in this context, that let us automatically change bids and change keywords and move bids around in an automated fashion rather than in a manual fashion. And so we're building a lot of those tools, not for sale, but just for ourselves in-house because of the kind of size of our marketing and then using a lot of Google's internal tools and looking at third parties as well, but I haven't found any of the third party ones that were better than what we could really do in-house and in conjunction with what Google provides.
You looked at any of these AI-powered SMS texting bots to improve lead conversion and engagement with leads? Are there any tools you're using on that front?
Yeah, so we, I have a tech background, so we develop most everything that we do in-house. So there's a lot of great tools out there. We do automated SMS within our platform, both with home sellers and with our real estate investor and real estate agent clients. So we've built a lot of that in-house. There's a, you know, for a non-tech savvy person, the SMS chatbot kind of things can be really good. Where I've found that they fall down is when the consumer or whoever you're engaging with starts to feel like they're hitting a wall with that thing, or it doesn't feel genuine. And as soon as that happens, I think you do more harm than good in a lot of ways. And so when you're designing those flows, I think it's just really important to take a step back and say, if I was the person that was in this interaction, would I get annoyed or frustrated with it? And if so, how do you back it up and make it really valuable to the consumer? Because I think ultimately the key in the lead gen world is how do you provide as much value to that consumer as you can? And as long as you keep providing value, they're going to keep engaging with you and kind of going down your sales funnel process, for lack of a better word. But as soon as you throw up a roadblock that frustrates somebody, even if it makes your life easier because it's automation, if it makes their life frustrating, they're just going to go on to the next person. So, you know, call centers are a good example of this. When you have to go through 10 levels of phone tree to get to the person that you're trying to get to, most of the time people just hang up. And as a business owner, you might say, well, that reduces my call center cost and it helps me qualify leads in an automated way. But you really have to measure how many people just fell out of the system because they were annoyed by all the roadblocks you threw up. And ultimately, it's about return on investment. So if you have a high call center cost or, you know, a high human capital cost of having people talk to your prospects early in the process, that might be a good thing because your conversion rates might be significantly higher and your attrition rates significantly lower by having that real human interaction with the consumer. One of the things that we coach real estate agents, brokers, and investors in our system all the time is with leads, for us, everything is real time. So somebody fills out a form on a website to sell their house for cash to an investor. 1 second after they fill out that form, we text message and email it out to the real estate investor. And we really work with those investors that you have to pick up the phone that second and call that consumer. If you wait 5 minutes even, that consumer is sitting in front of a computer looking at all of your competitors and you're just giving them time to go contact other people. You want to interrupt their search process, get them on the phone, engage with them, and stop them from contacting 5 or 10 of your competitors in the market. So now you're in a, you know, competitive situation. We actually built some technology around that where when a consumer contacts us online via a web form, when that consumer contacts us, we fire off a call through a call system to the real estate investor or broker. If they answer their phone, they hear a recorded message from us that says, you've got a new lead. Their name's, you know, Bob Smith. Their address is 123 Main Street. Press 1 to connect to Bob. And if they press 1, our system then dials the lead, the phone number that was on the lead. And if that person answers the phone, it live connects the investor, the broker, with that consumer. And it's amazing when it works out great because, you know, how many times have you been on a website where somebody fills out a form or you fill out a form to get information from a company and then your cell phone rings 5 seconds later? I mean, really, from a customer service standpoint, it blows people away. And so we love that technology. It's something we built in-house, but was pretty easy to build. And I think it really increases the conversion rates of all the leads coming through our system.
I want to touch on something on the traditional media front. You mentioned TV a couple times. When you think about TV, I'm going to assume you're referencing cable TV versus like the major network stations due to the cost. Is that accurate?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's all based on your scale. So if you run a, you know, real estate brokerage that has the scale to handle the number of leads that might be generated from a 6 o'clock news primetime television commercial, then that might be a good use of funds. Most people start on targeted cable TV ads, and that works really well because you can buy, you know, you can buy targeted cable TV ads for $15, $20, $25 per TV commercial every time they run. So you can build a pretty good kind of run of TV spots fairly inexpensively.
What would be an example of like a TV show that you would want to advertise on a cable network that would pull right. in a distressed
well, I'll give away all the real estate investor secrets right now. A ton of TV advertising. And the best returning TV shows for people that need to sell their house in a distressed situation are afternoon judge shows and kind of afternoon trash TV. And it, you know, we've talked a lot about why that is. And the theory is just that people are sitting around at home doing nothing. And, you know, why is that? Why are they sitting around in the afternoon watching television and not at work or not doing something? And oftentimes it's because they're in some type of distress situation. They've lost their job or, you know, whatever. And so we get a pretty good return from those. The 6 o'clock news works great, but it's pretty cost prohibitive to advertise on that these days.
So trash TV in the afternoons. Right. So everybody watching Judge Judy sit at home in a distress situation. Yeah.
Jerry Springer was a gold mine for house flippers.
Wow, that's great. That's cool. You know, that's good to hear because, you know, that's a very unique, it's much different than what a lot of people are preaching, right? That are, you know, preaching the direct mail stuff. So I think that's super, super smart. You're right. Cable TV is super cheap. You can even target specific geographic locations, you know, with cable TV, you know, based off the city. Are you finding, you know, for some investors in areas where it's highly competitive, for example, Austin, Texas, or, Charlotte, or, these markets where there's tens of thousands of agents and, you know, a lot of money, would it be better for somebody in one of those really competitive markets to try to buy in like a sub market, like maybe a town an hour away to have a better, when you look at your client acquisition costs and all your cost per leads and just overall like returns and stuff, would it be better for them to go to a sub market versus trying to compete in their respective markets where it's highly competitive?
Yeah, I'd say that depends, right? So it kind of depends on where you're at in your kind of real estate journey from a capital standpoint. How much money do you have to spend on marketing? From an expertise standpoint, how much can you be better than your competition in a particular area? I love segmentation, whether it's geographic, like you just talked about, or in other ways, whether it's your community, your passions around a particular sport or a particular hobby. I think trying to be all things to all people is really tough when you're in a really competitive market. But if you are, the king of your little neighborhood or your zip code, you can really make a lot of impact if there's not other people in that direct zip code that are targeting just people in the zip code. Likewise, if you've got some particular hobby that you're really involved in, maybe you love to, race cars or go to particular sporting events. If you're involved in that community, you can have influence in that community, even though your city might be really competitive, your competition within that community might be much less because you've built a lot of trust with that small community of people. So we find a lot of success in those areas. I do think going to secondary markets, if you don't have kind of the influences over particular communities already, and you're just looking at where do I want to go and kind of do regular advertising into an area and start a business, smaller markets are awesome for that kind of thing. Most of the really large companies just kind of stay out of them because there's not enough business there for them to really focus on. They don't want to drive an hour to list a house. And so you can market there less expensively, have more influence, build more of a brand in that market, and then move into the larger city. We see in the real estate investing world, I think some of the most successful markets or the most successful investors are not the ones in the major markets, right? It's not the LA, the Phoenix, the, you know, Miami markets that you hear about when it comes to house flipping all the time. It's a lot of these secondary markets like Boise and Nashville and Memphis and a bunch of these cities that don't get a lot of, you know, house flipping attention on TV, but they're a low cost advertising market. They're relatively less competitive when it comes to advertising. And we can just build a really big brand and be the biggest home buyer in that city because it's a smaller city and it's not a highly competitive market. So I think for people starting out, that's a great strategy of going to a submarket or a smaller area that you can kind of own.
Let's say you're not starting out. Let's say you're a very experienced investor that has a large pool of assets. Let's say you've got $50 million available to deploy. What would be your advice to somebody in that position that's really experienced, has a lot of cash at their disposal? What would be your strategy from a deployment perspective?
Yeah.
For someone that has that much?
Yeah. So we work with a lot of those kinds of guys and even kind of another level up, the hedge funds. A lot of these hedge funds are out buying huge amounts of single family homes all over the country. And so you can look at the formulas that they're using and really apply similar formulas, you know, for yourself. So if you are looking to build cash flow streams, so if you're looking to build a rental portfolio and you've got $10, $50, $100 million to do that, I think there's some things to think about. You can definitely run the numbers on any market and see the ratio of average rents to home prices and property taxes, which, you know, we're both in Texas. Property taxes are a really big factor in Texas, not so much in other areas. So you can run those ratios and make sure that when you add in all of your expenses and other things, the market that you're in is a good market for buying rental houses. If that's kind of what you're trying to do, is build a rental portfolio. There's lots of really great cities that are awesome for rental portfolios. And there's some cities that are just really tough for that type of business because the cost of the houses are lower. The cost of the houses are higher compared to rents, and it's just tough to cover your expenses with rents. I also think that you don't want to take a shotgun approach. Building a strategy and trying to keep a rental portfolio within a relatively smaller market is much more, a smaller area is much more manageable. So, you know, a lot of these people, they buy a house in one city and a house in another city and a house in another city, and they have property management companies all over the place. And that becomes very cumbersome to manage. You know, if you can buy 50 houses around Austin in the, you know, 5 or 10 cities in and around Austin, it's much easier to manage that. It's also much easier to package it up and sell it when you want to sell that portfolio, because you're likely going to sell it to an investor and all of your assets are in a centralized location. So I think that's a, you know, that's a really good strategy to think about. On the flipping side, you know, when you've got that amount of capital, you could really flip properties in any of the cities in the country. And so I think you, again, look at demographics. Where is an area where people are moving to because you want a ready source of home buyers? And then think about what's an area that has a high number of homes that need repair, because that's where a real estate investor really adds their value, is in buying something that needs work and fixing it up and selling it. And running those numbers for cities around the country and identifying a couple of pockets where that works really well. I mentioned Memphis. Memphis is one of the top markets in the country for rentals. There's a lot of companies, a few that are our clients in Memphis, that really run whole real estate businesses, buying houses, fixing them up, and then giving them to or selling them to passive investors that just want the cash flow. So they property manage the property all the way through, but they use the investor's money to buy the house, fix it up, and then cash flow it, and they get a property management fee on top of that over time, because the ratio of rents to home prices in places like Memphis are really good.
Cool. What's your opinion on iBuyers? What kind of impact is that having on?
Yeah, I've got lots of opinions on iBuyers.
Yeah.
So we work with a lot of them. You know, the iBuyers are really interesting in one way, because I came from a dot-com startup kind of world, and it's always a struggle to compete with a company that has unlimited or almost unlimited funds that doesn't have to show a profit by using those funds, right? You and me and everybody else in the real world that's building a business, you can't run at a deficit for very long before you go out of business or you have to, you know, go raise capital or do something else. A lot of these iBuyers are so well funded, they can operate at a loss because they're just trying to gain market share and prove their model. And I think it remains to be seen if their model in the future is going to be the same as the model that it started out with. But the net of that is that it makes it really difficult to compete, right? So our company, we spend huge amounts of money on advertising, and we now have to compete against the iBuyers for the same consumers with our advertising. And they're spending millions and millions of dollars on advertising, which drives the cost up for me and for you and for everybody else. I think the other thing that is a bit of a struggle is they have, because they do so much advertising, I think they have changed the perception of the consumer quite a bit on what a cash offer looks like. So 5-10 years ago, if you talked to a homeowner and said, you know, I can get you a cash offer on your house, people really understood that was a discounted offer, right? You're getting, you know, if you want to maximize value in your house and get the most, you should clean it up and fix it up yourself, or hire somebody to do that, and then put it on the market with an agent and sell it. That was the maximum value that you could get out of your property. If you wanted a cash offer, it was really around, you've got a bunch of work, you can't afford to do the work on your house, you just don't want to hassle with it, so you'll take a discounted offer to be done with it and move on and pay for that convenience. Now, I think the iBuyers have changed a lot of people's perception of what that cash offer looks like, and they think that it means a market rate offer. Well, and you and I both know that a lot of these iBuyers come in with a market offer, and then below that market offer, there are a ton of things that reduce the actual price the consumer gets down to the level that an investor would have paid him in the first place. But they kind of play this game where the top line number looks like it's the same number on Zillow. And so that sounds like a good price. Meanwhile, everything comes out of fees below that offer. So I think to kind of sum up, I think that iBuyers will be here for a long time. I think their business model is going to change. I don't think they make money as it is right now. They operate on super thin margins. And I think often they lose money on real estate transactions when you account for all of their expenses. But they're just trying to build as fast as they can and establish market dominance so that people will use them. And ultimately, they're going to have to raise their prices, not their offer prices, but they're going to have to raise their fees that somebody has to pay to use them to sustain. And then I think that's when we'll find out if that model is supported by the real estate market or not. But you kind of just have to let them spend their billions of dollars before we can find out if it's a model that's sustainable or not.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, one point I disagree on is I think they have, some of them have the ability to offer a substantially reduced service fee and use the acquisition as a loss leader to control market share and have leads and essentially develop a marketplace where they can have ancillary services that benefit when you sell your home to them. So, you know, it's going to be, the next couple of years are going to be really interesting because, between ancillary services, convenience, and I think something you might be surprised by is how low the service fees are. It's been pretty shot, it's been pretty, fortunate or unfortunate. I mean, it's good for consumers, kind of sucks for brokers and realtors is, these service fees are getting pretty close to what agents charge. They do back out repairs, but it's all, the same kind of stuff any normal buyer would be doing. So anyways, it's interesting, what'll be ahead of us in the years to come.
Yeah, I was at a conference not too long ago. Well, a little bit long ago since we're in the middle of COVID right now. But last year I was at a conference and one of the executives from Zillow was talking about their Zillow Offers program and, was saying our real goal is in many ways is to break even on the purchase transaction and make it all up on all the ancillary services. So the title work, the mortgage, all these other things that are not as price competitive as somebody looking at the sales price of their house that they can kind of add on and own that transaction soup to nuts, where everything is a company that the iBuyer owns and they're getting fees all along the way. So I think that's where that model is going. I think we just saw recently Opendoor is now a real estate brokerage and will directly list properties. So I think, in the long run they are definitely looking to disintermediate real estate agents and brokers and investors on the higher end of the market. I don't think they want to get into the really distressed property part of the market. It doesn't make sense for them to do that, but definitely on the minor repair side of things, we compete against them for offers on houses.
On a separate note, it seems like a place where barrier to entry is high and maybe there's an opportunity in competitive markets. What's your perspective, opinion, position on investors going after like $1 million plus homes in areas where the median price is only like $300,000 and, buying them and flipping them? Like, how many of those opportunities are going to pop up in like PPC type campaigns and things of that nature? Is that a lucrative opportunity? What have you seen in your 20 years of, flipping and helping people flip?
Sure. Well, I think the bread and butter of their market is always kind of the median value of whatever that market is, right? In parts of California, the median value is $1.5 million or $2 million. In Texas, it's more like, $250 or something, $220. So that's the median value and slightly below is kind of the bread and butter of the house flipper market. One, because there's a lot of inventory. Two, it's usually a group of people that can't always afford to fix up their property and when it's in disrepair. And three, you've got the most potential buyers for that property. So I think that's as a business model kind of to scale, that's where all the meat is on the bone. Now we have lots of clients that exclusively focus on a really high end market or a really low end market. They might be doing mobile home parks and that works great for them. And they make lots and lots of money doing mobile home parks. or they're doing really high-end luxury properties. You have to be, to do that, you've got to be very well capitalized, and you've got to be a lot more careful. Because in the luxury market, it takes a lot longer to sell a house because there's fewer buyers typically, especially if it's in a market where most of the houses aren't luxury houses. So if you're an outlier house, it takes even longer to sell that property. But I think there's a lot of opportunity in the high-end side of the market, but I would not do it as a novice real estate investor. I think you really have to understand the market really well, the market dynamics, because it's really easy to get caught holding a couple million-dollar property and paying taxes on it and holding costs, and that can eat up, you can dig a hole really, really fast if you're not real familiar with it.
So last question, I know you've got a hard stop at 11. Yep. What are you doing personally? Because you see so much on a national level. What are you doing personally from an investment perspective? What are you buying? What are you investing in? What's your personal strategy from a wealth building perspective?
Well, so I do a couple of different things. Certainly invest in real estate, although it's not my primary mode of investment. We just have a commercial office building that we bought and we're moving into our offices into. We do a little bit in the stock market. My passion is around growing businesses. I'm a kind of hardcore entrepreneur. I love building things and finding new ideas. So I really take most of my available capital and either pour it into growing the businesses that we have or look at acquiring other businesses. So I've, over the years, I've bought and sold a number of businesses. And I think for an entrepreneur type, that's a great way to really grow wealth, is buying businesses, kind of helping turn them around, and then selling them or keeping them for cash flow. So I do a fair amount of that. But real estate, I think, is an amazing cash flow investment that you just can't go wrong with if you do it consistently over time. And I also do a fair amount of hard money lending as well. So because we have so many real estate investor clients, we can loan them money at a very nice interest rate and get just a return on that. And it's great for them and it's great for us. And it's a lot less management overhead involved in those type of transactions than actually flipping a house.
A couple of quick things arose in my mind. We may have to schedule another interview because I would love to talk about the private equity and VC side of things. What are you personally offering people? What's the loan origination fee and interest rate? Do you require the investor to put up any cash in the deal? Like, what's that? What do those parameters look like for you?
We don't have a hard money lending company. This is really just me doing this for a select group of people that I know really well and have known for a long time and have a high level of trust with. Depending on the situation, it's generally something like 2 points and 14 or 15% interest rate. It varies based on the deal. No cash in from the investor. But again, it's not something we're offering to, the market. This is just, when you have some cash, where do you put it? Do you put it in the stock market? Do you put it in real estate? Where are the areas that you can deploy that capital? And for us, that's been some hard money loans to only people that we know for a long time in the local area. And we're not trying to build a big business around it, but I do a fair amount of that.
What are your, I promise this is the last question. I got to ask this on the private equity side. So on the private equity side, what kind of businesses are you, do you like buying? Is it more tech stuff or are you interested in like service businesses that, great cash flowing businesses? What do you like on the private equity side?
So I love businesses that have recurring revenue. So subscription-based businesses, all of the businesses that we operate right now are all kind of subscription-based where you sell one time and then you have recurring revenue streams off that one sale. And I have a preference for things in the real estate industry because it's just an industry that I know really well and understand and have a lot of influence and connections in. I think especially if you're buying multiple businesses, it really helps to buy businesses that have a common, kind of a common theme. So, we've got 4 or 5 real estate related businesses right now that all can feed each other. And so it makes it a lot easier to take a company and then start to scale it up faster because you've got all these other resources in the other companies that you can use to enable that. So I really try to stick with real estate related and then subscription type recurring revenue technology businesses, online type of businesses.
Are you intentional when you go to sell them, or is it you just, you know, you get solicited an offer, or do you have, you know, yeah, is there like a strategy for you on the, once after you acquire it, what's like the exit plan?
Well, what I love about recurring revenue subscription businesses is they cash flow really well. And so, you know, my goal with these businesses is to get them into a really stable position with good management and then keep them for a long time. So most of the acquisitions that have gone on have been other people approaching us, not us trying to shop it out to the market. Because you know, once you've got a business that's generating a really good cash flow with good management in place, unless somebody makes you a really sweetheart offer, in the long run, you're better just holding onto that cash flow and use it to deploy and buy other businesses or do other things with it.
What do you like more, starting something from the ground up or buying somebody else's business and modifying and improving and building upon
it? That's a good question. At the beginning of my career, I always loved starting things from the ground up. It was just, you know, I love starting things. It's a lot of fun. I think the longer that time has gone on, I much prefer buying something that's existing, tweaking the dials and making it better. The startup process, you know, at the very beginning, the startup process is just really difficult. So if you start something from scratch, there's so many things that you've just kind of got to do to get the machine rolling. And if you can step into somebody else's machine that's already running and optimize it, I think you can turn things around a lot quicker. It just shortens the period of time that you've got to do the really basic business building stuff, and you can focus on the optimization.
Cool. Jeremy, yeah. Thanks for being on, man.
It was a fun conversation. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I was hammering you with a lot of questions, and I appreciate your transparency. It was great. Guys, thanks for tuning in to CEO Secrets. Be sure to check out fasthomeoffers.com if you're looking for distressed seller leads, or if you're looking for a licensing package to help you level up your marketing, check out WeBuyHouses. And tune in to CEO Secrets next time. And if you're watching this on YouTube, don't forget you can always plug in via iTunes. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Jeremy.
Take care.
Want more CEO Secrets? If so, you can get a free copy of my book, The Million Dollar Real Estate Team, at www.themilliondollarrealestateteam.com for free. Inside this book, you'll find my top secrets that we've used to net $1 million in just 3 years.